Hello, this is Peter Jones bringing you one in a series of podcasts on behalf of Lancashire Authors Association, purpose of which is to speak to local writers and sometimes historians to get an insight into how they came to do what they do and a bit more besides. These podcasts are not confined to Lancashire, however, and sometimes we will cover topics farther afield to discover a wider view. If you're wondering why you're not listening to the dulcet tones of D. Garrett Nadeau, who normally conducts these interviews, then wonder no more. He is in fact sitting right next to me and is the subject of this podcast. Welcome, Dana.
Hi, thank you for having me, Peter.
Now, could you tell me a little bit about your earlier life, Dana, before you actually came to these shores?
Yeah, I was born in the States. I was born in California, actually, but moved fairly soon. My parents took me to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is where I really grew up. I really had no hankering or idea that I would ever end up sort of living outside of America. That all came about as a kind of a series of events that I probably won't go into at this time. But suffice it to say, I've lived not only in America, but I went and lived in Africa, in Nigeria for 4 years, and then in Switzerland for two, and most of my life I have actually lived in the north of England.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about those early years? I mean, I believe you used to live on the coast, or you were born on the coast.
Well, I was born on the West Coast.
Yeah, the West
California,
Coast, yes.
California, yeah.
That's right.
And yeah, didn't stay there very long, and then went to Lancaster. And the high school that I grew up with, Hempfield High School it's called, it was really very much like Happy Days. I mean, there was no hint of any kind of the troubles that occur in schools nowadays. No guns or drugs. There was no drug scene, drinking. I mean, the worst thing you could do as a student was probably smoke a cigarette in the toilets. That was like a really bad thing to do. That was it.
And now that's even worse these days, smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, well, this is before the days of the cancer and all that sort of stuff. It was just that smoking in a toilet was just taboo, really.
Okay, tell me something about your education then, starting with your primary education and working that through.
It was a very basic education, and I didn't appreciate it at the time as much as I do now. If you take, for example, grammar, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades, that's sort of age 14, 15, 16, 17. Those grades in school, in English class, we did punctuation, tests. And, you know, an introductory subordinate clause is always followed by a comma, two main clauses connected by a conjunction, need to be preceded by a comma. All of that stuff was drilled into me. And now, as a writer, of course, I appreciate that. And I feel I know the rules of punctuation very well. But at the time, it was a bit tedious. I didn't.
And do you think that possibly that actually made you into the writer you are today? Do you think that actually told you, yes, I've got to do this because I love the sound of words, or I like the way that words look on a page?
Well, I think it was important sort of subconsciously because it made me aware of structure, of sentence structure and the construction of sentences. In terms of length of sentence, because a main clause with lots of prepositional phrases is slows the reader down, whereas a short main clause may speed it up, etc., etc., etc. And I wasn't specifically taught that, but I think I certainly learned that. And when I did start reading, because I mathematics was my forte in high school. And I really didn't read very much. I'd maybe read three novels by the time I got to university, probably more than that, but I mean not very many. And it was only at university where I switched to English literature. But that mathematical background and science background, I think, caused me to look at writing and at literature as a structure. And it begins with the word. And then it grows into a sentence, which grows into a paragraph, which grows into what in America you call a composition or an essay, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So that kind of structure that grows from the individual word and the emphasis on individual words, say in poetry or whatever, then becomes a bigger structure in terms of sentence construction, which becomes a bigger structure in terms of paragraph construction, which becomes a bigger structure in terms of the essay composition.
I see what you're saying. But you mentioned that you were going to major in sciences and decided to change, and I believe that was just the chagrin of your own father, wasn't it?
Yeah, he wasn't very happy about that. He had this vision of us going down to North Carolina and setting up a business, and me being kind of the computer expert. This is back in the 60s, before the computer industry had really taken off. I can remember him investing in IBM and saying, well, this is the company of the future. And I wasn't quite so sure that computers weren't just a fad, but he turned out to be right there. But he wasn't very happy with the fact that I switched into English. He couldn't see much future in that.
Do you ever regret it?
No, I don't. I love reading. I love literature. I think it sort of brought something into my life that's fulfilled my life more, I think, than mathematics would have done. Although I try not to predict the future, because who knows? When you start saying what if is for fiction. I think what if is a great question to ask yourself, which is what I do in my novels. What if there were aliens here? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We can talk about your novel a little bit more later, Dana, but I just wanted to get a little bit of that background. Now, you're a big guy, you're 6'2", and you're built really, you know, you're very solid, we'll put it that way. And you were very good at sport when you were...
Yeah, I played a bit of sports. I don't know about very, very good, but I did play high school football and played baseball, and I was on the wrestling team and stuff like that,
Yeah, so were you ever good enough to be playing for County, National, or whatever?
No, only 10-pin bowling. 10-pin bowling was, I did at one point toy with the idea in my head about becoming a professional 10-pin bowler.
Wow.
And I won a number of tournaments and championships in America and here. But, I don't bowl anymore.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what happened after you left the States, why you left and where you went. But I think, first of all, we could possibly have your first piece of music, which you've chosen here, and it's by the Rolling Stones, and it's Satisfaction. I'll ask you a little bit more about why you chose this after we listen to it.
Okay.
Thank you, Dana.
I tried.
Yeah, that was the Rolling Stones and Satisfaction. Can you tell me a little bit more about why you picked that piece, please?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. Number one is, of course, the Rolling Stones were very, very popular in the States at the time. second probably to the Beatles. And English music was very significant, and a significant influence. But Satisfaction itself was a musical piece that, in many respects, in terms of the lyrics, took quite a risk. And of course, we all loved that because the 60s in America was a kind of a revolutionary period for teenagers, where we were kind of rebelling against the adult world. And I've always tried to balance, kind of in terms of my writing, the required structure that is necessary and the techniques that are necessary against taking risks and doing things that are unexpected and that are pushing the boundaries a little bit. So I try to do that in my writing. So Satisfaction in that sense has been quite an influence.
Well, thanks for that. Right. Now back to your college at America, and when you graduated, I believe you didn't stay in the States. You moved abroad. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, that all came about because I grew up Quaker. They built a Quaker meeting house near where I lived, and coincidentally, I just started attending and became a pacifist. And because I became a pacifist, I had to serve alternative service to the draft. So instead of going to Vietnam, we were required to spend 2 years sort of for a nonprofit organization. So the Mennonite Central Committee had a program in Africa where people could go and teach for 2 years to serve that service. So I joined, I was sort of able to go to Africa, to Nigeria through the Mennonite Central Committee. But I really didn't know what to expect. It was quite an eye-opener going and living in Africa from America. Especially since in the 60s, Lancaster, Pennsylvania was quite a sheltered.
So it was a massive culture shock for one thing.
Oh, it was big. They tried to prepare us for it. But I'm not sure that you can prepare for anything like that. It was quite different.
So what were your thoughts when you were going there? A bit of trepidation there? Or?
No, I wasn't. But I, because again, this thing about risk and being careful. I can remember one of the things I did when I got to Nigeria. I used to clean or wash the skins of the banana before I would eat the banana, because I was afraid that I would touch something on the skin of the banana and then touch the banana itself and get something as a result. So I would actually clean the skin of the banana before peeling the banana. I was that careful.
Right.
I learned fairly soon after that wasn't quite
necessary.
Yeah,
I suppose you couldn't really go through all those years
no,
doing that.
No, you couldn't.
So tell me a bit about Nigeria, how you found it and how you left it.
Well, I thought the people were wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I mean, they were so kind and generous, and they looked after us and friendly. I think one has to be a little bit careful about getting into political debate, because they have strong political feelings. And I think with any visit to any country that is not your own, one has to be careful about criticizing. It's interesting, like even here in England, if I were to say something that was maybe perhaps slightly negative about England or the north of England or wherever, being with the American accent and everything, I have to be careful that what an English person can say is not necessarily what I can say, because it's interesting that people will take, or more likely to take offense here, if I say something negative. And I don't have very much negative to say about England. I like it. I love it here. So
yeah, it's rather the same as anywhere, isn't it?
Yeah,
natives
it
are allowed to complain.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely.
But you can't do it yourself. So
right. Well, I mean, in your book, The Clove and Pine, there is quite a bit of African influence, although it's set in Idaho. Can you tell me a bit about why, you know, did Nigeria sort of influence the book? And tell me a little bit more about your book, and maybe finish off with reading a little bit from it.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, one of the characters, his name is Innocent, is an African boy who comes to live in America with the family of Conrad's family. And I've always been interested in this contrast between people who are of African descent and who are African, and Americans who are obviously have not been born and raised in Africa. And I think there is quite a difference, even though they have the same historical heritage. There is a difference of outlook, etc., and I'm interested in contrasting that. And the second book that I'm writing, which is called Vulture Soup, is based in Africa, and Innocent is there, and there the tables are turned, because Conrad then is in Africa, and Conrad is the visitor, if you will, living in Africa, and Innocent is the native, as opposed to the other way around in the first book.
Well, that's a very interesting concept, and obviously Africa did really play a big part in that. Yes, could you read a little bit from the Cloven Poem, possibly, to illustrate some of this?
Yeah, I will. I'll read just from the first very beginning of it. This is chapter one of the Cloven Poem. The 25th of April, 1964, crept forward under a dark disguise of grey cloud, dense as set fog, a relentless drizzle misting over the hills and seeping into the forests. I was soon to be 10 years old, out of breath from running because I was sure they had seen me, and expecting them to appear any minute out of the greyness to shoot me. It was 3:30 in the afternoon, but it could have been any time of day, except that Dad had looked up into the early morning as the cloud descended and said something wasn't quite right when the pale disk of the moon persisted so late into a new day. And the clouds wanted to hide that moon like it was some sort of a big secret. My dad had a number of things peculiar about him, including a way of expressing himself that annoyed people. They couldn't separate the wise man from the fool, which Dad wasn't, though mostly they thought he was. I'll stop there. That's enough.
That's fine. Right. Thank you. Thanks for that, Dana. Just a bit about Nigeria. You taught these children in Nigeria. I'm presuming that you got very close to them and they were sorry to see you go. Why did you go? And we'll talk about where you went next.
Well, they weren't children. I actually taught in a teacher's college. And what was happening at the time was that many of the teachers who were qualified to teach in primary school had reached a certain level of education, but the government had decided that they wanted them to have more training and to be better qualified. So they upped the level of a required training for the teachers, and so many of them went back to school, if you will, or college. So this was a teacher's college. So many of my students were in their 30s and 40s. I was just 25 years old, and they were significantly older than I, some of them maybe in their 50s.
Right.
Very few of the students were young. Some were in their 20s, but quite a few of them were older.
Oh, right. I understand. Yes, so that was quite an experience for you. And perhaps, did you find that some of them resented somebody younger than...
Absolutely not. No, they were so respectful. They called me, sir, can I carry your book, sir? Whenever I walked from class to class, someone would rush over. Well, they would all rush over and offer to carry my books for me. They very much wanted to learn. They were never any trouble at all. They were very keen and enthusiastic students.
Excellent.
Wonderful, really.
That sounds really interesting. Right, we'll talk a little bit more about you leaving Nigeria and where you went next, but I think we need to go to the next piece of music,
okay,
which is, I have to say, is one of my personal favourites, and it's The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. Restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound. Silence, and in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did disturb the sound of silence. Fool said, I do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words, like silent raindrops, fell. Echo the will of silence. The people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls. Tenement halls whispering
silence. Hi, welcome back to this podcast featuring D. Garrett Nadeau, and I'll ask you a little bit about that last song, The Sound of Silence, Simon and Garfunkel. Why you chose that, please?
Well, again, as with the Stones, Simon and Garfunkel were very, very influential in the 60s with their music, etc. And all the music I've chosen in some way relates to my work as a writer. I think, writing, as I think I've mentioned elsewhere, is quite an isolated kind of task. One is alone, with one's computer or pen and paper or whatever. And, it's a lonely job. And The Sound of Silence, I think, reminds me of that, feeling of isolation, of being separate, and of really also being thoughtful in terms of full of thought, thinking about things, trying to work things out, trying to understand things. There's a bit of melancholy there. I suppose it goes back to the romantics and this nostalgia kind of an aspect to it.
And of course, Paul Simon, one of the original great poets, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. His lyrics are tremendous. You know, they're very, very poignant and moving, and emotional. I think writing needs to have an emotional quality to it so that it raises emotions in the reader, either, you know, to make them laugh, make them cry, that kind of a thing.
Absolutely agree. Pathos and comedy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very important ingredients. Right. Back to Nigeria now. You left Nigeria when and why, and where did you go next?
Well, when I was in Nigeria, the Peace Corps, who had been there, the American Peace Corps, had got themselves into a bit of trouble, and so they'd been asked to leave. So there weren't very many Americans there. In fact, in Keffi itself, that's the town that I was in the middle of Nigeria, I think there was only one other couple that was American. So most of the other teachers there were either, from India, from Britain, or were Nigerian. And, of course, all of those three countries, heavily influenced by the British educational system, and, in fact, the Teachers College was based on the British educational system. And, of course, within a bit of banter, etc., it was made fairly clear to me that an American education wasn't worth the paper it was written on, and that I should have a British degree. So, because I studied English literature as an undergraduate, I thought, well, England would be a great place to study. To further study, in English literature, and I can actually be in the place where it was written. So, because also I'd read American authors as an undergraduate, most of my undergraduate education in English is English literature, not American literature. So I applied to various universities in England, and I was accepted at Leeds University. So I went there. I went there to do my postgraduate study, and that's how I ended up in the north of England, really.
Right. But in between then, didn't you have a stint in Switzerland?
No, I was actually at Leeds University, and I didn't have much money because I hadn't been you can't earn much. If you're doing alternative service, you're not allowed to earn very much money. And I didn't earn very much money with the Mennonite Central Committee in Africa. I had about £1,000. That was it to my name when I came to England. Which was just about enough to see me through my first year at the university. So I needed a job, a summer job. And somebody saw this ad in a paper and said to me, oh, there's an ad for the American school in Switzerland. And I applied for that, and I got a summer job there. So I worked summers there while I was doing my postgraduate degree at Leeds. Then when I finished at Leeds, they offered me a permanent position at the school, American school in Switzerland. And I originally went as an English teacher, but within a year became what they call academic dean, which is the kind of the person who's under the vice principal of the school. So I was really in charge of all the other teachers, organizing the timetable and doing some administrative work, as well as doing the teaching in English literature.
And Switzerland, most people would die to live there, wouldn't they?
Well, I don't know if they die to live there. That's kind of a contradiction in terms. If you're dead, you can't live there. But anyway, it was an interesting experience.
That's just like saying, give your right arm to be ambidextrous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think a lot of people think of it as a wonderful place to live. And certainly the scenery was fantastic. And, it was very, very clean, an extraordinarily clean place. I mean, one of the remarkable things was seeing somebody hoovering the sidewalk or the pavement outside their shop. I'd never seen anybody take a hoover outside to actually do some hoovering. So that's an example of how clean it was. And the problem, you know, if there's a problem, was that at 9 o'clock at night, it was dead. I mean, there was just nothing was happening. It was.
Don't they have some sort of curfew there?
Well, no, it wasn't. Well, it felt like a curfew. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody went home. There was nothing, very, very quiet in the town at sort of 9 o'clock at night. Just very few people around. A few people would go to restaurants and things, but, no trouble. You know, again, no sign of any sort of raucous behavior or anything like that. So it was a very quiet place, and it wouldn't be to everybody's taste. It wasn't an exciting place to live, although we did have some adventures at the school, but mostly around the students who were American. Well, actually, the students at the American school were from all over the world. So we had Iranian students, we had Italian students, we had American students. We had quite a mix of students, which again was an interesting experience culturally. We even had a couple of Japanese students, you know, from Japan.
And did you learn to ski while you were there?
Well, no, that I had a very bad experience when I was 15 skiing. So I didn't do any skiing. The school actually did move to St. Moritz for a week. After Christmas, in January, the whole school went to St. Moritz and, that's when the students would ski in the mornings, and then we'd have lessons in the afternoons. But in the mornings, I kind of stayed in the hotel and kind of looked after things, which turned out to be fortunate when the hotel actually caught fire, and I discovered the fire and saved the hotel from burning down.
Well, there you go.
That's a true story.
A superhero to you. That's it.
Don't know how heroic that was. But.
Okay. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about your time after Switzerland, and we'll also talk about how you came to live in Accrington of all places. But first of all, we'll have another piece of music. Now this time, it's Elton John, and I'm Still Standing.
In a simple way, and if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did, looking like a true survivor, made were meant to cut me down. And if my love was just a circus, you'd be a clown by now. No, I'm still standing better than I ever did. Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid. I'm still standing after all this time, picking up the pieces of my life without you on my mind. I'm still standing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm still standing.
Okay, that was I'm Still Standing by Elton John. Could you tell me a little bit more about why you chose that, Dana?
Yeah, well, again, this goes back to me writing. This is another aspect. Every writer, including myself, has suffered rejection. And yeah, that's par for the course. And I think as I was learning to write, too, I took a number of writing courses at university. And I didn't get top marks all the time. I didn't get straight A's. I would get a B or whatever, and I'd have to cope with that. And my whole life I've spent trying to learn to cope with criticism, because all writers get criticism. And sometimes you feel pretty beaten up after, somebody's had a bit of a go at whatever it is you've written, because not all that I write is as good as maybe the Cloven Pine is, I like to think anyway. And so I'm Still Standing is kind of representative of me still able to stand up after these severe beatings that I get from my
criticism career. Is the bane of every writer, isn't it? And it's how you deal with criticism that decides whether you grow or whether you go into a shell, I suppose, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Right. Tell me a little bit more about Switzerland, when you left, and what you did when you came back to this country.
Well, Switzerland, I worked in Switzerland for those years, and then, I got this, opportunity to do postgraduate study at Leeds. So I came to Leeds University, that's really where I did what's called an MPhil. I did a thesis on, moral conflict in the novels of Charles Brockden Brown. Charles Brockden Brown was, the first man in America to earn a living as a writer. Way back in, you know, before the American Revolution and during that period of time, wrote six novels, etc. I won't go into a lot about Charles Brockden Brown.
No.
You can look that up for yourself if you like. And then really got that job in Switzerland while I was at the university there, and then did that. But I had met, while at university, I had met a Liverpool lass, and we decided to get married, and which we did. And so she wanted to be a solicitor. So although she joined me in Switzerland and taught at the school there for a year or so, we then returned to England, to the Liverpool area where she qualified as a solicitor. And, she was my wife for 20 years.
An American as a scouser, that must have been an interesting experience for
me. I had to learn how to say things like, where's my shirt? Is that a good Liverpool accent?
It still didn't work.
No, I'm not very good at accents. I'm afraid. On paper, maybe. On paper, maybe I can do it, but not so well, sort of orderly.
Right, and so Liverpool. How long did you stay there for, and how did you like it?
Yeah, we were married 20 years, so I lived in Litherland, which is just outside the city, I would say, then, and then moved to Town Green, which is out sort of past McGull, And then ended up in Skelmersdale. So I lived in Skelmersdale.
Skelmersdale. Was that Skelmersdale Newtown in those days?
Yeah. Well, we didn't call it Skelmersdale Newtown then, but it was Skelm.
It was one of
Skelm
the new,
is what we
call it. It's a bit like Milton Keynes. It was one of the new towns.
Yeah, it was a new
outside
town.
The city.
Yeah. I heard that the woman who designed it committed suicide afterwards, but I don't know whether that's true or not. That's one of these things that people tell you that you think, well, you know, that's.
Yeah, that's very. So while you were there, I mean, I believe you worked at St. Helens, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Well, I had a number of jobs. I went into the computer industry. I had been a teacher up to that point, but I thought, I'm going to get myself in trouble here with parents if, as an American English teacher, my students start imitating an American accent. Parents are going to sort of say, why are my kids... Because that's what people do. People meet me, and at some point, as they become confident enough that they won't insult me, they then start trying to imitate an American accent. So I get that all the time. Mm-hmm. And I had this vision of my students going home with imitating an American accent, and their parents saying, "Who taught you that?" My English teacher. And then saying, "Excuse me, I thought we were supposed to be learning English here, not American." So I thought, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So I went into the computer industry. Ironically, of course, my dad had wanted me to go into the computer industry 20 years before
whatever. Yeah.
And in defiance, I had not done it. And then in the end, I had done it, which by the time word reached him, made him even more confused and hurt, I think, to some extent, that I had refused to do it with him, but then later on ended up in the industry anyway. So I don't know, maybe I was a bit naughty there, I guess.
Oh, well.
I didn't do it intentionally, but that's just...
How long did you stay there?
Well, I was 20 years in the computer industry. I was a long time in that. And I worked for big companies and small companies. I worked for Royal Insurance when the Royal Insurance Company existed. I worked for a building society, the Liverpool Building Society, when it existed.
Right.
I then worked for the co-op in Manchester, Co-op Realty Services, and I worked for Pilkington Glass. And there were quite a few other companies in between. In the 80s, the computer industry was quite a volatile industry in the sense that companies would hire big groups, big teams to create systems, which we would do. But then they would have this glut then of people they didn't know what to do with. So then you would get offered these really nice, massive redundancy packages to go away. And so you would then go off and sort of work as a team for another company. So it was quite good, really. I got paid well, and then I would get paid well to leave. I remember one time, just to give you an example of what would happen is, one time I got called into the office. This was a Friday at about 11 o'clock. Called into the office and given my letter and said, "I'm sorry, we're having to make you redundant." I went back to my desk. The phone rang. As I got back to the desk, I picked it up. It was a recruitment agent saying, "I've heard that you're being made redundant." How he knew that, I don't know. I guess the company had
headhunted already. Eh?
Yeah. Then he said, "Are you interested in another job?" I said, "Yes." "Can you go for an interview?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Can you go now?" I said, "Yes." So I had permission to go. So within an hour, I was at the Royal Insurance. I went for this interview, where they talked to me about America and skiing and snow and all this sort of stuff. They never asked me about my work at all. Mm. Went back to my desk at 4 o'clock, got a phone call from the recruitment agent, said, "How did it go?" I said, "I don't think it went very well, because they didn't quiz me on my work or anything." He said, "Well, actually, they've called me back and they want to offer you the job, and they forgot to get you to fill out the application."
Huh.
"So when can you start?" I start anytime. "Can you start on Monday?" "Yeah, I can start on Monday." So I went in on Monday and filled out the application for the job that I had just been given. And then I had to go down to the basement to get my desk and carry my own desk up, or get somebody to help me carry my own desk up in the lift to the office and set up my own desk. So that's the way it used to happen.
You know, you couldn't believe that. You wouldn't write that now, would you?
No, nobody would believe it.
People are fighting for jobs.
They wouldn't believe it.
But the thing, when we talk about computers in the 80s, it was more like the mainframe stuff.
Oh, yeah, they were
nothing
big.
They were
humongous things. They were big things.
Okay, well, we'll break to another piece of music now. And this time, I think you want to listen to the Traveling Wilburys. and the end of the line. Dana, now that was the Traveling Wilburys and the End of the Line. Can you tell me a little bit about why you like that and about the group?
Well, of course, the End of the Line, and I'm sorry if this sounds a bit morbid, but the End of the Line thing makes me think about death. Now, it's not that I worry over much about my own death, but I think any writer, I've got a book at home called Love and Death in the American Novel. I think love and death are aspects of writing that certainly play an important part, especially if one is writing detective fiction, which part of The Cloven Pine is detective fiction. So there are, and my other novels will have deaths in them.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't Woody Allen direct a film called Love and Death at one stage? I might be wrong.
He may have done, yeah. I don't know. But as I said, I think death is an aspect that sort of plays its part in literature. It's a significant part of all literature. So again, it has that kind of reminder. I mean, it's my understanding, for example, that in the Middle Ages, the academics would have a skull on their desk, to remind them of their own mortality. Again, whether that's true or not. But that kind of aspect to this whole, juxtaposition of life and death and birth and rebirth and all of that. Is significant.
It's a very interesting concept, that, isn't it? I mean, the skull on the desk and everything, you know, Yeah, I can quite
to stop you from being too big-headed. Yes, if I can
well,
that's that.
A, yes. Well, then we all need one, probably, don't we?
Yes.
Anyway, let's go on to Liverpool. When you left Liverpool and moved up north, 20 years, I think you said you were married to your first wife, and then things went wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, things didn't work out. It was quite an amicable split, as splits go. But I think we didn't have children, and we were both equal in terms of our earning power and that sort of thing. So maybe the breakup was too easy. I think we'd kind of drifted apart is how I would phrase it. And I think that the break was a good one in the sense that both of us are now happier. I've lost track of Janice, so I don't know where she is or what she's doing. But I'm hopeful that she's happy, as sure she is that I am. But after that, I then joined this what's called Northern Link for unattached professional people, which is kind of a dating thing, I guess. Well, it's a way of meeting people, for single people to meet people. I was 50, and I started going along to that, and it met a few people. I wasn't necessarily looking for a new partner. I just wanted to socialize and get out because, again, as a writer, doing the writing thing is quite a lonely, isolating kind of thing, and I thought I need to socialize. And that's when I met Anne, who is my wife now. And Anne is actually born, bred, raised, lived in Accrington, which is how I ended up in Accrington.
Well, somebody has to, haven't they? I've been here all my life, so
yeah,
it's not a bad town. It used to be a great town, and just unfortunately going through a bit of a rough stage as far as jobs are concerned, and as far as a lot of shops in the town are closing.
Yeah, the shops closing down.
It's very sad. Yeah,
that's a sad business. I hope that Accrington can pick up a bit.
No, I hope so too. I mean, it's obviously. And Accrington Stanley, of course, you know.
Oh yeah, that's a great one. I never saw the milk commercials. I think I did see them. There was a program on telly. I have seen them, but I never saw them when they first came.
That was one of the great Liverpool players, wasn't it? Ian Rush, you know, we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite funny, and they're really good advert source. Right. Let's talk a bit about, obviously, you joined several writers' groups, and we'll talk about Lancashire Authors in a moment. But when you came up here, what did you do for work when you came up
here? Well, I was still working at Pilkington's when I came up here. So I stayed with them for a while and was still sort of scribbling away in the early morning hours or late nights, depending on my mood or what I was doing at the time, still trying to get published and get my writing done, etc. So that was my life then, really, pretty much.
And you're now a very hard-working member of the Lancashire Authors Committee. We're trying our best to get Lancashire Authors Association more members and bring it up to date, get younger members. This has always been a sort of a goal of ours, and we sort of bang on about this, but we are really, really trying. We're doing these podcasts. We're also trying to integrate with schools and get younger people involved and all this. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic organization. I mean, I'm very impressed that it's been going since like 1909, and that it's had some illustrious members. And I'm a great believer that we should encourage and foster writing throughout the county. And I think there are some great organizations, some great clubs. I belong to quite a few, about five now, I think, that I belong to. And I really enjoy going along for the social part of it, but also because we do help each other and encourage each other. Sometimes writing in isolation, it can get a bit discouraging. You think nobody's ever going to read this, nobody's ever going to see this, and it's just why am I doing this? Why am I, you know, pouring my heart and my soul into trying to create this paragraph or this dialogue? And it's writers' groups help promote that, help encourage you, and Lancashire Authors is part of all of that.
Well, I'm a great believer. There's quite a lot of untapped raw talent.
Yeah, absolutely.
In this town, never mind anywhere else, and definitely over the county.
Yeah.
And I think if we can unearth some of that, we'll have done something good, won't we?
I think being creative is an important aspect of the human condition, and I think it is therapeutic. I think it's cathartic. I think there are all kinds of side benefits that writing can give one. And it's not always necessary to be published and to be famous and to make loads of money. Very few, a very small minority of writers ever reach that point. The majority of writers, and I would say there are thousands of writers in Lancashire alone, who don't aspire to or need to or achieve those kinds of levels. So I think we mustn't lose track of that, those people, really.
No, I think I saw something. Well, I was actually privileged enough to be at Julie Hesbenhell's Freedom of the Borough night, and she made a very interesting speech in which she said, and she said it to all these kids that were gathered in front of her, for every poem you write, for every story you write, doesn't matter if it's published, doesn't matter what happens to it after, you're making the world a better place. Yeah. And I think that was really well said and very true of anything. Anything you create is bringing something into the world which should enrich it in some way, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I agree, because writing does require us to think about the human condition, to be aware of the human condition, and the importance of our moral responsibilities in terms of the environment or in terms of how we treat each other, etc. So writing is important from that point of view as well, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, there's only very, very few people who could actually make a living just from writing alone.
Yeah, it's very hard.
And
to do that
if
now.
That's what you're going into it for, maybe you're in the wrong profession, because really you should be doing it because of the fulfillment it gives you.
To be honest with you, I don't think you can sustain that motivation if it's all about the money and the fame.
No.
I think the great writers, the famous writers, the Stephen Kings of this world, will write and write and write, the J.K. Rowling, etc. They still, even though they've made loads of money and they could easily hang up their pen, if I can use that expression, they could easily quit and not do it anymore. They're still driven to do it. They still continue to do it. They can't, that is part of who they are.
It's a fulfillment of what they're writing that's a prime mover.
Yes,
what
it, is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is. Really, the fame and the money are, in fact, sometimes I think they get in the way. Yeah. I think Ernest Hemingway and other people like that, I think were kind of overwhelmed by the whole thing and may have, ended up sort of making wrong decisions.
Okay, tell me, now, you know, we've spoken quite at length here about Lancashire authors and what we're trying to achieve, but like you say, you're a member of quite a few writers' groups. Tell me a little bit about those groups, if you would, please.
Well, again, it's because I like the social side of it and because I like the feedback that I get. So there's Clitheroe Writers, that I belong to. There's Clayton Lemoore's Writers, and there's Oswald Twissell Writers. So I go along to all of those. I have been to visit the Chorley Writers, and there was a peer writers group that's just started in Morecambe that I have gone to. Some of these I don't necessarily attend anymore or all the time. Accrington Writers, there was an Accrington Writers group
for a long time that I
was a member. Writers groups do tend to come and go. That's why Lancashire Authors is so impressive, because Lancashire Authors has survived for a long period of time. Most writers groups only last 2 or 3 or 5 years.
106 years.
Yeah, that's, most writers groups do not last that long. And they get resurrected, or a new group of people come along and start them over again. But people move on with their lives. Writers kind of come and go. Not all writers write every day of their lives all the time. Some people go through phases, which is fine. So.
Right. Let me just ask you something now about your writing right now. How difficult is it to have that discipline to write a novel? And, you know, how do you actually motivate yourself you've done one, you've got one in the bag, if you will, and to an extent, you look back and think, oh, I've achieved that. That's brilliant. And you could sit on your laurels and not write anymore. So the next one is going to be more difficult. And how do you galvanize yourself into writing that next novel?
Well, my first response to that is impossible. I don't. I haven't. And I'm not very good at working on Vulture Soup at all. I'm a bit naughty that I don't work on it like I should. When I do work on it, I enjoy it, and so I don't know why it is I find all these distractions. but I am not a regular writer. I aspire to be, and I would like to be, mm-hmm. and I try to make myself get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write for 3 or 4 hours, before I have a bite of breakfast or whatever. I can't say that I do that on a regular basis. I am slogging my way through it. But no, I'm not. I'm not anywhere. In fact, I chide myself for that. I probably could have written 100 books by now if I'd been more dedicated, but I've only written one. So hopefully yeah. the next one, Vulture Soup, won't take 50 years like it's taken to produce it.
Well, the world is waiting. The world is waiting on tenterhooks for
this.
Oh,
are they? Okay. Yeah. With bated breath.
Okay. Before we actually go to the last piece of music, I'd like to ask you a few things about what you do other than writing, and also about what you do to relax.
I watch a bit of television. The TV that I watch, the videos that I watch, again, always, there is some aspect that is working in my head to create this series of novels that I'm creating. It's always about plot construction or character or scenery or philosophy, psychology, whatever aspect of a particular film that I'm watching or series of films or television series like Spiral, or even if it's a foreign series like Valander or whatever, I'm always thinking about the writing, really.
Right, well, that's a very good answer. And I think what you're telling me is that when you are relaxing, you're not really relaxing. You're thinking about what to do the next novel.
I find it fascinating. The construction and writing of a book is a fascinating process to me. So I don't need to relax from that. No. I find it very exciting and enjoyable. So
I cathartic.
Yeah, it is, and it kind of helps keep me sane if it's possible for me to say that I'm sane. I'm not sure that I am. Can you define sanity for me? I'll tell you whether
this is the thing. You see, you don't get a certificate to say you're sane. You only get a certificate to say you're insane.
Oh right.
So if you've not got one to say you're insane, you must be sane.
Okay. All right. That's as good a definition as any, I suppose.
Right. So. We're going to end with is there anything else you want to say before we actually finish this?
No, except thank you very much for having me, speak to you today. I hope it's been of interest to the listeners.
And thank you, Dana, for a very interesting interview. I've really enjoyed talking to you and listening to you. And you have a very interesting life, and, I hope you have a lot of success with the next novel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Right, the next piece of music is Mozart, and you're going to tell me a little bit about why you chose Mozart, aren't you, before we go?
Well, Mozart, this is again one of these things that somebody told me one time. I've heard that apparently if you listen to Mozart while you're working, it helps the creative process, that you're more creative, you're a better writer or a better artist or whatever, if you're listening to Mozart at the same time. I don't know whether that's true. I don't usually listen to music while I'm writing, but I will listen to music if there are dogs barking outside or there's some kind of distraction going along around the house that I can't get out of my head. I'll put Mozart on. And of course, I can't say that I've seen any difference in my writing as a result of Mozart, but maybe.
No, it's pleasant to listen to anyway.
It is, so, yes.
And we all like a little bit of classical music.
What a great genius that we all can aspire to be.
So. Was he writing at 6 years old? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
My goodness.
That's
fantastic. Okay, well, thanks again, Dana, and all the best, and I hope to be seeing you more in the future. Lancashire Authors, and let's hope that we can get things going.
I'm sure we will. Thank you again.
Thanks. Bye. The other.
Thank you.